I'm David Lazarus in for Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of April 3rd, 2015. When I talk about economic cycles, what comes to mind?
Economic cycles?
You buy something and then you sell it to someone.
Having stuff at home and then bringing it to a store for recycling.
The waning and waxing of the economy, how it's pretty cyclic.
The consumer buys something within like 6 months is already something else.
Some cycles help us grow, some burn us out. We're looking at both on this week's Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. We're looking at all kinds of cycles in the show, the kinds that are planned, the kinds that sustain us, and, of course, the kind that you peddle. What are the cycles that affect your personal economy? Let us know by visiting MarketplaceWeekend.org and clicking on Go, or you can tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. But first, as you know, we here at Marketplace are all about the numbers. And every day in our Buy the Numbers blog on Marketplace.org, we give you the numbers worth watching. Numbers like 126,000. That's how many jobs were added in the U.S. last month, according to Friday's jobs report. And that was sharply lower than expected. Here's digital producer Tobin Lowe to catch you up on other doings in the economy. Buy the Numbers. Hi, Tobin.
Hey, David. So, our first number,
6,500 stores,
is how many GNC stores there are nationwide. The diet and herbal supplement industry has come under fire recently for accusations of unlabeled ingredients in their products. In response, GNC announced Monday that it would adopt new testing procedures that go above and beyond what is required by federal law.
21%.
That's how much Ivor's Salmon House in Seattle is increasing its prices. The reason? The iconic eatery is raising base wages for the whole staff. The increased pay will also make up for the fact that the restaurant is getting rid of tipping altogether. The move comes right after Seattle raised its minimum wage to $11.
50%.
That's the percentage drop of U.S. oil rigs since October. But this week, there were signs that the oil drilling crash may be slowing down. And in spite of dwindling numbers, drills have become more efficient, meaning the amount of barrels we're pumping hasn't seen much of a change.
Visit the Buy the Numbers blog at Marketplace.org for a serving of each day's most important figures. When you listen to Marketplace, you'll hear the word cyclical a lot. Cyclical earnings, cyclical economic stats, financial markets that seem to spin in regular cycles. Well, we decided to drill down and take a closer look at the oil market, which has been in the news a lot lately and touches every one of us in the form of pump prices and the delivery cost of nearly everything we buy. The big headline lately is that the price of oil keeps falling. That's a different tune from the beginning of last year when oil producers were singing,
"Come fly with me, let's fly away."
Is this just the nature of the oil cycle, or is something else going on? To help make sense of it all, I'm joined by our resident explainer, Patty Hirsch. Hiya, Patty.
Hello, David.
Let's start at a macro level first. When we talk about cycles in markets, I'm guessing all that goes up must come down.
That's absolutely right. So a cyclical industry is one that tracks the wider economy, right? When the economy is doing well, that industry booms. When the economy falters, that industry does poorly. And a great example of this is cars, right? The auto industry. It was one of the biggest casualties of the Great Recession. You know, look what happened to GM. And you remember that, you know, car makers had to put all of those incentives on the lots for people to buy cars. Well, that was the situation then when the economy was down, but now the economy is recovering. Auto sales are doing really, really well, and you're starting to see that industry really lifting right now.
All right, well, when it comes to oil, that seems counterintuitive because the global economy is growing, and yet we're seeing oil prices coming down as if there's not a lot of demand.
Oil is a commodity, right? Just like wheat or gold or copper or whatever. And oil, like all commodities, is seen as a cyclical business. That's because as the global economy improves, you're going to see demand increase, right? The more people drive, the more demand there is, so therefore you're going to see prices rise. That goes for wheat, you know, because it's a food product. That goes for copper and steel because people are constructing more. So the more demand there is for that stuff, that obviously you start to see prices rise. But there are all sorts of other pressures on oil right now other than what's going on in the economy. You've got OPEC pumping large amounts of oil. You've got U.S. shale companies still pulling oil out of the ground despite the fact that it's really, really costly and expensive for them, really because they're just trying to survive. You've got the fact that we're probably going to see Iranian oil coming onto the market pretty soon. And then there's the strong dollar, which is also a factor. So there are all these other things other than just the economy that are playing on oil right now. And that is why you're seeing oil really not acting in a cyclical way.
So should U.S. drivers, and the U.S. accounts for about a quarter of all oil consumption globally, should U.S. drivers think that prices at the pump are going to stay at these low levels because of this huge abundance of supply you're talking about? Or inevitably, will pump prices go up?
Well, I think in the short term, you're definitely going to see prices low, all right? And they may even fall further. I mean, some people are talking about $25 oil for a barrel of oil. Right now, it's right around 50. So yes, you probably will see that effect at the pump. But oil, like I say, it's a global commodity and it is cyclical. So let's not forget that oil right now is on this very big downswing after an enormous upswing. I mean, remember, it was like $149 oil. Remember that? So there's nothing to say that as the economy booms again, and when I'm talking about the economy, I'm not talking about the US economy, I'm talking about the global economy. So China starting to demand more oil, all the African countries demanding more oil. As demand in these countries rises, as the global economy improves, you will see demand lift. And there's nothing to say that we won't see ourselves back at $149 or even more. Oil is really cyclical. The proof of that is the swing that we've seen. So in a way, oil is like the most cyclical of cyclical industries.
Patty Hirsch, as always, thank you so much.
That's my pleasure, David. Thank you.
There are cycles everywhere in our financial lives, but there's one cycle to rule them all, our sleep cycle. How and when we sleep impacts our work, our finances, even the overall economy. To get a sense of the value of a good snooze, we're checking out the night shift at a diner. That's where Monica Schrock works long past the time most people have tucked themselves into bed. And she says, that's just how it is.
I also have a day job, so I do choose to work at night because I have my own business and I'm trying to build that up, so I work at night to kind of moonlight. I'm serving the late night shift at Bright Spot Family Restaurant. It involves seating people, taking orders, running food, doing to-gos, drinks, kind of managing the floor and the host and the busboy and helping out everyone. I'm the only server on. It's changed over the years, actually. I've been here about 5 years, and the people that used to come in late at night were super drunk, and it was always kind of wild. Now, sometimes we get that, but it's kind of just like chill people eating late and hanging out and having pie. We sell a lot of pie late at night, but a lot of young people usually at night, I would say. It can screw up your sleeping schedule to work late at night, because if you don't work late every night, you're screwed up throughout the week when you don't work late. Like, I work 3 or 4 night shifts, so I have 3 days where I'm not working late, so I have to kind of still sleep that schedule in order to keep it normal. Yeah, it can be kind of life-altering. My sleep cycle definitely disrupts it. I don't want to sleep in too late because I feel like I'm wasting the day, but then I end up not getting enough sleep because I can't go to sleep when I get home from work because I'm all hyped up on working for 7 or 8 hours and I'm not tired. And then I go to sleep late and I don't want to waste the day because I have to be back at work at 5 or 6. So I just want to like get up and do things. So I end up getting less sleep than I should probably. I would say that I'm not unhappy with it. I get envious that people have nights off and they just work during the day and they get to go home and just like hang out and watch TV and read and stuff. But it's really chill at night. Like diners in the morning, you're kind of really turn and burn and it's crazy and there's lots of people and it's like out, out, out. Everyone wants out at night. It's a little more chill. So it's a more laid back vibe, definitely, at night than in the morning. Waiting for. A sleep cycle is a delicate thing. Researchers say most people need at least 7 hours to feel rested the next day. But what happens if you don't get that amount? Ken Wright is a sleep expert at the University of Colorado Boulder.
All life here on Earth, or most life on Earth, has within it this internal clock. And that clock tells us when we should be awake and when we should be sleeping. And it's very difficult to override that biology. If we don't get our recommended 7 to 9 hours, it leads us to have increased risk of developing a lot of health problems, such as heart disease, diabetes, cancer. But also, it increases our risks of accidents, such as drowsy driving accidents. But shift work itself goes beyond just not getting enough sleep. It's being awake at a time when our circadian rhythms are telling us we should be sleeping.
Obviously, if we're not getting enough sleep, it's taking a toll on our mind and body. But what's it doing to our economy? How does that affect things like productivity?
Well, sleep loss and working the night shift reduces productivity on the job. We know that productivity is reduced by at least 5% compared to day workers. And then the estimates of the economic cost of sleep deprivation in today's society is over $100 billion per year.
Does that mean that if we actually got a good night's sleep, the economy would be $100 billion richer?
Well, that means if we didn't have to deal with the reduction in productivity, the increased accidents and the costs of recovery from those accidents, yes, indeed. If we were able to get better sleep and we didn't have a sleep-deprived society, there'd be a better economy outcome.
What kind of accidents are you talking about? Like I'm going to hit somebody driving home after a night shift, or I'm going to drop something really heavy on my foot?
Both are great examples. People have a 4 times to 10 times increased risk of falling asleep at the wheel on the way home after a night shift.
As a sleep-deprived yet well-meaning people, what do we do about that?
Well, I think we have to recognize that shift work does go against our fundamental biology. And there are strategies that we can do to help improve the process, such as making sure that we get enough sleep. And this may be for a shift worker done in 2 bouts instead of the normal 1 that a normal day worker would have. So, for example, your typical shift worker, when they get home from a night shift, they may stay awake a little bit. Then they'll sleep for 5 to 6 hours or so. And really, that's not enough sleep for them to make it throughout the rest of the day, and especially throughout their night shift. And so taking a couple-hour nap in the afternoon before they go on to that night shift is one way of helping them. And then there's ways of trying to improve wakefulness, too. Utilizing things like caffeine, not all the time, but just trying to prevent you from becoming sleepy. And then there's some brand new research that has come out of Europe that has shown that perhaps we can think about whether someone's a morning type versus someone who is a more evening type. And those evening types tend to do better on later night shifts, whereas the morning types tend to do much better on the early morning shifts that start, for example, between 4 and 7. So if we take into account people's differences in their biology, we may be able to improve the situation.
How many hours of sleep do you get a night?
I get my 7.5 hours every night.
And that's all there is to that. Ken Wright is a sleep expert at the University of Colorado Boulder. Ken, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure to be here.
We're talking about economic cycles today, and that includes the Darwinian struggle that seems to define the markets for new technology.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology. This is Tech in Real Life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to Tech IRL. Hiya, Ben.
Hi, David.
Hey, so when I think about tech, I look at it from the end user experience. I'm interacting with a website. I've got the gadget in my pocket. But that's not where these things began. Let's talk a little bit about the life cycle of technology, where a tech company or where a gadget or gizmo started.
On the first day, the primordial ooze of a tech company is an idea. It starts with a person to sell an idea to the world. But before the world buys in, venture capitalists have to buy in, David. Startups go through different series of funding. A lot of venture capital support is kind of based on this 5-year life cycle. And that means new companies have about 5 years to prove themselves to their investors, to prove themselves to the market before they run out of cash or run out of steam. So a startup becomes kind of middle-aged as it attracts a user base or a client list or figures out a way to make revenue. Startups have wildly different life cycles depending on their ability to do these things, to find these ways of staying alive, shall we say.
Do they actually have to make money, or is the whole game revenue? That there's some sort of cash flow, but profits, a secondary consideration.
Well, if you were watching the GoDaddy IPO this week, David, you know very well that they don't have to make any money. They can have an initial public offering, maybe with money coming in, but also with a lot of overhead. It's actually more important in some ways to have a user base, to keep that user base, and to have almost the idea that people get really excited about that may one day eventually make a lot of money. David, have you heard of Meerkat?
I have heard of Meerkat, but I thought Meerkat was like so 24 hours ago.
So 24 hours ago. And there's a reason for this, right? Meerkat became this kind of media darling. Everybody was talking about it. It was an easy way to stream social mobile video, so to speak, or stream video of yourself sitting at your desk or doing something boring to people on the internets. But while Meerkat had a lot of attention, it didn't have something that a competitor had, Periscope, which you must know if Meerkat is old news, Periscope is the new news. Periscope's a similar service. It does a lot of the same things, but Periscope had been purchased by Twitter. And it's really nice when you have a parent company with lots more marketing power, other kinds of power to get you out there into the marketplace and get a user base for you and get people interested in the service that you offer.
And it shows how fickle tech users can be, that one day we're all in an AOL chat room and the next day we couldn't find an AOL chat room with a flashlight. But that's kind of the software online side of things. What about hardware? Same sort of deal?
Well, hardware, yeah, there are a lot of similarities, but some differences too, David. What kind of phone you got?
I've got an iPhone. Prior to that, I had a BlackBerry.
This is an interesting example. Now, let's look at Apple for a second as an example. You know, sometimes the user gets to define the life cycle of a device, and sometimes the company gets to define it. And Apple has actually become really good at defining the life cycle of their devices. Every fall, Apple comes out with a new version of an iPhone or a new version of its operating system or a new version of the iPad. Now, in the case of the iPhone, a lot of people upgrade. You know, some might say because the operating system just slows the phone down and drains the battery. Some might say just because their phone is so essential to them, something they interact with every day, it's really important to have the latest and greatest. But here's an example where Apple actually doesn't get to necessarily define the life cycle of its device, and that's the iPad. A lot of people use their tablets really as an entertainment device. It's not as essential. And there haven't been leaps and bounds forward in the technology that go into tablets necessarily. So you can still use, I don't know, a second generation, third generation iPad and just have a great time with it. And you don't feel like you need to have a new one. And we've actually seen this happen more and more with all kinds of tablets and people not buying the latest version because the older version works just as well. So sometimes the user gets to define that life cycle. Sometimes the company does. And sometimes in Apple's case, both happen.
And that's the life cycle for this conversation. Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech, and he's our guide to tech IRL. Ben, as always, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
How about getting some of our tech in your life? Download the Marketplace app. You can find it on Google Play or in the iTunes store. We've been talking about all kinds of cycles, work, financial, tech. It's about time we addressed the two-wheel variety, bicycles.
Bicycle, bicycle.
That's become easier to do in more and more places thanks to bike share programs. But can they work everywhere? Martha Roskowski is Vice President of Community Innovation at the national nonprofit People for Bikes. So for the uninitiated, what's a bike share program all about?
Bike share systems are publicly shared bicycles in communities across the country, around the world. Generally, there are stations. You'll find stations where you can go check out a bike either for a day or you can have a monthly or annual membership. You go up, you take a bike, you ride it wherever you want, you check it in to that station or another station when you're done with that ride. The idea of it is that you use the bike just for a trip. It keeps the bikes in circulation. You ride a bike and then within half an hour or with some systems within an hour, you dock that bike, you go in, you do your shopping, you get your coffee, you do whatever else. You come back out, you check out another bike and you can go to another destination. So the whole idea is that these bikes are available and they're regularly turned over so that many, many people can use them.
It sounds expensive to get one of these programs up and running. Is this something that a municipality funds, or is this something that requires corporate underwriting, or both?
Both, generally. You know, the perhaps most famous system of all in Paris, Vélib, sort of the granddaddy system, is underwritten by a big advertising company called JCDecaux, and it was a trade. JCDecaux put in and operates the bike share system in return for doing billboards and public advertising in Paris. So that was one of the original models. Now, in the United States, it's a variety of things. Often cities are coming up with public money, either local money or perhaps federal money for the initial capital. And then they are working with sponsors like Citibank in New York, like Independence Blue Cross in Philadelphia, Barclays in London, to cover part of the operating costs. And then you pay to use the system. Like all public transit systems, I don't think the user fees are ever going to fully cover the cost of all of it, like buses where, you know, the fare box, what people pay, doesn't cover the cost of it. That's where the sponsorships come in.
So are bike share programs looked at as an adjunct to public transportation, that this is going to be a part of the larger equation of getting people out of their cars?
Absolutely. There are systems in small cities like Boulder, in bigger places, and a lot of the users are locals who use it as a way to get to transit, you know, first mile, last mile. It makes transit work better. It also helps when transit is overcrowded. You know, during peak hour times, people can hop on a bike share instead. So it, in a way, it improves the reliability of all of these systems. I would say the other big piece of bike share use that we're seeing, though, is just for recreation, just for fun. People wanting to be healthy, tourists traveling around town, checking out their city. So it's really both.
In New York and elsewhere, it can cost over $100 a year to join a bike share program. And at that kind of money, you can go out and buy yourself a pretty good used bike. How do you make these programs more accessible and more affordable for people who would love to be a part of them?
Philadelphia is doing some really interesting work. They're going to launch their bike share system on April 23rd. And after doing a lot of focus groups with folks in disadvantaged communities, they decided not to do an annual membership, that was just too big a chunk of money for someone on a fixed income to come up with. And instead, people said, let us pay for this like we pay for transit. Let us do a day pass or a single ride pass, or let us do a monthly pass. So Philadelphia will not even be doing an annual pass. $10 for a month is a lot easier a bite than $100 for a year, or, you know, that kind of thing. So I think increasingly the system operators are listening to their potential users and figuring out how to make pricing of bike share look more like pricing of other things that people are already comfortable with and familiar with.
Do you think pay-as-you-go is going to become the industry standard?
I think either pay-as-you-go or short-term, like monthly, so that people can decide from month to month if they want to re-up their subscription. Or ideally, your transit pass will also operate as your bike share pass, so that you don't have to have four different cards in your wallet and flip through and, you know, make them all work.
Has your polling showed that people who get into and enjoy a bike share program eventually end up buying their own bike and biking more in their spare time?
Yes, the kind of initial survey work shows that. We have anecdotal evidence, stories from bike shops who tell us about people who got on a bike for the first time in 20 years because a friend said, hey, look, let's hop on this because it's so easily available. And then they rode it and they had a great time. And then they're going into bike shops and then buying a bike later on. Bike shops in some areas have been hesitant about bike share coming in, thinking it's going to replace their business. But I would say in general, once the systems are on the ground, bike shops and others are seeing that it's actually augmenting their business. That once you get back on a bike, you think, wow, this is fun. And maybe I need my own bike.
Martha Roskowski is Vice President of Local Innovation at the Colorado nonprofit People for Bikes. Martha, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The big wheels keep on turning, and not just on that bike of yours, but also in the economy. In marketing, cycles dictate advertising campaigns. Depending on the season, you'll be pitched for all sorts of different things. Therese Wilbur of USC's Marshall School of Business is here to tell us more.
Here is your year in commercial marketing and advertising. In January, of course, we start with New Year's and New Year's resolutions, which means that it's a great opportunity for diet services, because everyone has a New Year's resolution to lose weight.
If you're bored and you know it, eat a snack. If you're lonely and you know it, eat a snack.
Then after that, we go into getting ready for the Super Bowl. So we have the NFL playoffs in January and the Super Bowl beginning of February. You're going to see in grocery stores huge pallet displays of chips and soda. In February, of course, the highlight is Valentine's Day.
The craving for chocolate is
and of course, there you're going to have everything from chocolates to flowers, anything your sweetheart would enjoy, such as perfume. It's a key time for fragrance sales.
Her kiss. Her smile.
Leading into March, everybody will be getting ready for Easter as soon as Valentine's Day ends. So, of course, all of the Easter candy and Easter basket goodies are going to be available.
I can't let allergies stop me from leading the way, so I get Claritin Clear.
Key allergy season would be coming into spring.
Allergy season. I love the smell of pollen in the morning.
When you get into spring and summer, that's a key time for your home improvements. Everyone gets ambitious and wants to, for example, paint their home. April's a little bit of a lull for the retailers. But we get into May. May is a huge retail month because of Mother's Day. Everybody gets their mom a gift or at least a card or celebrates with her. And then, of course, we'll get into the beginning of summer with Memorial Day, which is considered, you know, the traditional beginning of summer. So we have all of our summer toys out and activities and swimsuits. In June, we have Father's Day, not as big as Mother's Day. A lot of giftable items for Father's Day, technology, for example. Also for graduation, technology is a big one.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC.
In July, we have 4th of July, anything related to cooling off. June, July, and August are actually high sales for gas and vacations and resorts because that's when typically children are in school.
We've heard that over 400 million vacation days go unused every year.
That's the stupidest thing I ever heard. They're paid vacation days.
If you guys agree to travel more, we'll all do better in school.
You'll start to see back to school trickle in July for sure. Preparation for school starting in August and September. So back to school will be a big focus. And retailers will be happy. They've kind of gotten out of that summer lull, getting ready for the height of the retail season, starting with back to school in August and September.
Bye, Mom.
Bye, sweetie. You'll do great.
This is it.
A new school year has so much potential.
October is a highlight month now. Actually, October sales passed December sales just this past year. The real highlight is Halloween and how much U.S. consumers have really gotten into Halloween.
Hey, little M&Ms. Wow.
It's Halloween time, my frightful fiends. Disneyland is ours!
Get into November. Highlight being Thanksgiving, which is a huge occasion for food and beverage sales. And Black Friday being the busiest shopping day of the year.
It's on, Black Friday's almost here. We should totally shop forever.
Smiley face, don't be late, or whatever.
What if you could shop forever?
October, November, and December are when most engagements are planned. Most engagements actually happen in December, so it's a key time for diamond sales for rings.
There are two things in the world that last longer than time. Love is one of them. A diamond is forever.
Of course, December, we have the holidays. So we have Christmas and then we have New Year's. And most people actually do their shopping about a week before Christmas. Retailers are trying to get rid of inventory kind of at a higher price before it goes on sale after the end of the year.
We want to hear from you. Tell us about your year in spending, what you buy and when, regardless of when someone's trying to sell it to you. Write to us. We're at MarketplaceWeekend.org, or you can tweet us at MarketplaceWKND. Today on the show, cycles. We've talked about reusing, recycling, discarding. But what about the other side of the equation? Things that go the distance, maybe even for the rest of your life. We asked you last week, what's the one thing you bought that you didn't have to replace?
It's a product that I buy that I don't have to replace ever.
What do I buy that lasts forever?
That I'll never have to replace?
I don't know. I cannot think of one.
I'm not sure.
I don't know.
I have my sewing machine too, which is old and just keeps going. Those things are pretty indestructible.
Yeah, I'd say my guitar is pretty indestructible. I do have to change the strings, but it lasts, you know?
Let me think about that a second.
Yeah, I'm a photographer, and I have an old Leica camera, and I know that I don't have to replace it ever again.
I would say a watch.
It's going to last forever, yeah.
For some lasting advice on this, we turn to Lauren Lyons Cole. She's a financial planner and contributor to TheStreet.com. Hiya, Lauren.
Hi, David.
So nothing is forever, really, but at least from a consumer's or an investor's point of view, you really want to get your money parked in something that will give you maximum bang for the buck. Why is that so hard?
Well, you know, I think any time that we're looking for good value, we run into this problem of shifting trends. We run into the problem of quality. Where was this made? So there are a lot of challenges when it comes to finding something that's going to last.
Now, is it possible to actually go out and do some comparison shopping? Or by and large, is everything out there designed to have a shelf life or a product life of 1, 2, 3 years maybe, and then you're going to be out shopping again?
No, I do think it is possible to do comparison shopping, and I think it's important because with most items, we could take a laptop, for example. You could buy something that you know is going to last 3 to 4 years at a certain price point, or you could look for something that maybe is like a netbook, something a little cheaper, a little bit less permanent, and you're going to pay less for that. So you can really compare those as far as how much you're going to pay and what sort of time frame you can expect to get out of the product.
You manage money for a living. How do you do this sort of thing?
That's a good question. So I don't really like to shop, actually. So I have a whole different motivator in this process, which is that I would prefer to do the comparison shopping, the research up front, buy something that's quality, mainly so that I don't have to think about it for years to come. So, and of course, there's also the element of getting good value out of something.
Does this sort of thinking also apply to the investment world? Do you want to buy a so-called value stock that in theory is going to be a good bet for a buy and hold portfolio? Or is it better to bring in a little bit more risk, with that risk being that you might have to get out of that position more sooner than later?
Buy and hold is something that has worked very well for a lot of people over time, value stocks, blue chip stocks, certainly. And I think this comes back to my point about I'm not really passionate about shopping. So I'd rather do my research, buy something, and have it last. And I think for most consumers, most investors, that's really what they're looking at when it comes to their portfolio. We don't have many people who are willing to put in the amount of time it takes to really take on that risk and trade stocks actively.
Attention spans are very, very short. Do you think that it's just simply a fact of life, at least from the consumer's or investor's point of view, that we're going to want the next big thing? We're going to want a little more razzle-dazzle in our lives, and therefore we should always anticipate change in what we buy, and thus trying to buy that shoe that's going to last forever, for example, might be maybe not the best idea.
Well, it's funny, actually. There's this whole psychology element to this, which is a lot of times it's actually the anticipation of buying something new that is really what we get excited about. We're not as satisfied by actually making that purchase. And time again, research has shown that spending money on experiences more so than stuff is actually a much better use of money. And I think that might be something, you know, if anyone has a tendency to want to shop or to buy new things, it might be worth taking a step back and to, you know, really reevaluate that choice.
Good advice. Lauren Lyons Cole is financial planner and contributor to TheStreet.com. Lauren, thanks so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And now let's take a quick look at a couple of businesses that do make products meant to last a lifetime. Zane Shent has been making knives for as long as he can remember, and the same can be said for his father. Zane joins us from the New West Knifeworks production floor in Idaho Falls, Idaho. So Zane, when I go into one of your stores and buy one of your knives, you're never going to see me again, right?
In essence, yes. You won't have to come back for that same knife, but we believe you'll come back for other purposes because every knife is designed for a specific purpose.
Ah, and how many different knives do you make?
Currently, there's around 20 different knives, but there's lots of variations of each knife.
Does it ever frustrate you that when you buy any other consumer product, whether it's shoes or a belt or a coat, that it doesn't come with a lifetime guarantee?
Absolutely. It drives me crazy when I buy things all day long, and it's basically I'm buying it to replace it in the near future. And we build the exact opposite. So, yeah, it definitely frustrates me.
Do you think that consumers want that, or are consumers fickle and they're looking to change at regular intervals?
I believe nowadays their mentality is that they are used to changing things. They're used to buying something very cheap and very low quality, and their kind of the mentality is, yeah, we can change it. You know, we can go buy another one. We attempt to change that mentality and that thought process by putting a true quality craftsmanship in their hand and allowing them to feel the difference and allowing them to see the performance for themselves and starting to understand that, hey, not everything has to be swapped out, you know, every 3 or 5 years. I can actually have something that lasts forever.
When you're looking at what your craftspeople are doing and you want to test out the quality, how do you test out, let's say, the edge of the blade to know that you've got a top-of-the-line knife there?
It goes to, you can check into the Catra test for edge retention, the sharpenability. It checks the steel, but we can actually take it in and do rope cutting tests. You do a product, basically demolition test, to see how far you can take that knife without it being destroyed. So there's a very extensive testing process that goes into our product well before a customer ever sees it.
I've read that knife makers actually have to scrape their arms to make sure that a knife is up to snuff.
We all kind of look like we have mange in a way because we do check our edge retention and how sharp our knives are by seeing if it'll shave. So all the guys in the factory all have dots off of their arm from their hair because we do quality check the edge on batches to make sure it'll shave your arm.
I'm sorry to laugh, but I'm just trying to picture what your workforce looks like.
Yeah, my wife hates it, and our workforce looks like, like I said, looks like we all have mange. But we all kind of laugh about it here in the factory. We know what's going on.
Zane Schenk oversees production at New West Knife Works in Idaho. Zane, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And speaking of longevity, how about cast iron skillets? These things are passed down from generation to generation in many families, usually getting better with age. Bob Kellerman is CEO of Lodge Cast Iron, which makes some of the most popular skillets on the market. All right, Bob, why sell a product that never has to be replaced?
Durability is one of the many beauties of cast iron. It just, you know, gets better with age, just like women and whiskey. It's very versatile. You can use it on the campfire. You can use it on your grill. Cast iron is cheaper per pound than hamburger meat and lasts a lifetime. It's a heck of a bang for the buck.
If you sell products that last forever, how is it that your company can grow? Because at some point, everybody who wants a skillet has a skillet.
Well, we're chasing the international market, and there's a big old world out there. And our export business is growing. We're in about 50 different countries at this point.
And are all of your products basically products that will last a lifetime?
That's correct, Dave.
Again, I'm having real issues with where you see your growth.
We basically reinvented cast iron cookware back in 2002 when we introduced Foundry Seasoned Cast Iron, because before it used to have to season the pan at home, and the process for a lot of young home cooks was a little intimidating, but now they can buy it already seasoned, black with an oil finish, just like buying grandmother's pan right off the shelf, ready to use right out of the box.
Why? But a cast iron skillet needs to earn its stripes, no?
It will. Buy one and check it out.
Bob Kellerman is the CEO of Lodge Cast Iron. Bob, thank you so much for joining us.
David, I enjoyed talking to you.
Next week, we're talking renewal, a clean slate, a new beginning. For a lot of you, that can mean weddings. Whether it's your own or someone else's, a lot of money changes hands. So we want to hear from you. Visit MarketplaceWeekend.org and click on Go. Or you can tweet us. We're at MarketplaceWKND. It would be nice if everything was like a cast iron skillet or a steel knife. You buy one, you never have to buy another. The reality, however, is that much of our economy is predicated on the idea that things break down, often with suspicious regularity, or a new and improved model will be introduced, even though there's nothing wrong with the old one. There are two words for this: planned obsolescence. To tell us more about this phenomenon, we're joined by Michael Waldman. He's a professor of economics at Cornell University who has studied planned obsolescence in the economy. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So when we talk about planned obsolescence, in a nutshell, we're talking about what?
Well, there's actually two different types of planned obsolescence. There's the type of planned obsolescence where the product just wears out and wears out too quickly in a sense. But there's also the type which is actually kind of more where the term came from, which is that the manufacturer intentionally introduces a new version of the product which makes the old version obsolete. So even though the product still works, people stop using it because they want to go to what's new.
Well, let's talk about that, because on the one hand, you would think that manufacturers would pride themselves on making quality products that are the best they could possibly be. But from a business point of view, maybe that's not the best way to bring in the cash.
Yeah. So, you know, so one example would be if the consumers are uninformed or have difficulty identifying how long the product is going to last, the manufacturer's kind of sitting there saying, well, gee, if I put more durability into the product, so it would last longer, but the consumers can't tell, and so they're not going to pay me the extra money, then there's no return for me to do it. So that's a very simple reason, a very simple story, which could lead to kind of planned obsolescence along the line of the product not being sufficiently durable.
But it would seem like this flies in the face of capitalism, where capitalism says I'm going to sell a good product for a fair price and maintain a relationship with my customer. This seems to be more I'm going to sell a so-so product for as much as I can possibly get and hope nobody notices.
Well, you know, when you think about economic theory, capitalism, as you're describing it, sort of leading to socially efficient outcomes, holds under certain circumstances. So it holds when everything's publicly observable, the consumers are very rational and knowledgeable about the products, and you can have lots of different types of good contracting outcomes, then you're going to get the type of efficiency you're talking about. But in the worlds that I'm talking about, maybe there's a lack of information on the part of consumers, or there's a lack of ability for the producers to commit, then what you get is what economists call market failures. And this idea of planned obsolescence, the different types of planned obsolescence that economists have discussed in the literature are basically market failures of a sort due to these different types of problems. You can also get kind of these issues coming up if consumers like newness, but then there's other consumers who don't like having oldness. And so then you'll also get kind of too much introduction of new products, which will lead to old products being obsolete. There are lots of economic theories which say when you go away from the idealized world of very traditional economics, then you can start getting market failures and getting these outcomes which economists and the lay public call planned obsolescence.
So when a new smartphone comes up with only negligible improvements, is that an example of too much?
I would think. At least from the societal standpoint, given the costs from the environment and disposal costs from a societal standpoint, seems to me like it's too much. And I certainly don't replace, you know, I don't replace my phone very often, but I'm not subject, I don't think, too much to these issues.
Tell me a little bit about some time when you went out and you had to buy something and you said to yourself, I shouldn't have to buy this so soon. I just bought one of these.
I have a very basic lifestyle. So, you know, I had a cell phone. I almost never use my cell phone. I use my cell phone to make calls, but actually I never take calls on my cell phone. I don't want to be bothered. You know, you want to call me, go to my answer machine. So I could use my cell phone forever. I thought, I'll never have to replace this thing because I only use it for the most basic of things. But what happened? Well, eventually my cell phone stopped working. And it wasn't the fact that it was wearing out because I was basically never using it or almost never using it. And so I eventually had to go buy a modern cell phone. I was actually quite annoyed about it.
Michael Waldman is a professor of economics at Cornell University. He's done extensive study into planned obsolescence. Michael, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
In today's show, we've looked at all kinds of cycles. Cycles in tech, cycles in marketing, recycling, bicycling. We're ending the show today with one more cycle. Gary Shigehato Green grew up in Los Angeles. He worked for a pool maintenance business. Eventually, he became the owner, but it all fell apart. Gary soon found himself desperate to find work. He found himself homeless, and then he discovered a new job. And for the last 20 years, he's worked for himself, selling what others throw out, recyclable trash. producer Jenny Ament caught up with Gary and his shopping cart at the Temple Street Recycling Facility in Los Angeles.
I found a whole turkey today. A frozen turkey. A whole frozen turkey. Basted?
Basted turkey.
Basted. Yeah, thank you.
Where'd you find it?
I found it in a dumpster when I was recycling.
Why would somebody recycle a turkey?
I have no idea. I guess they had no use for it, and so they know that someone will find it.
People like you were going to come by and go through the recycling.
Exactly, exactly.
Tell me a little bit about you.
Well, it's getting more personal now. My name is Gary Shigeharu Green. Believe it or not, 62 years young. And I recycle plastic cans and bottles every day.
You put a receipt in your pocket for...
Oh, this is a receipt from Temple Recycling Center. The first item is the cans. I have 2 pounds of cans, and that pays $1.59 per pound. Glasses pays 10 cents a pound. So if you have 100 pounds, that's $10. I have 69 pounds. That comes out to $7. Plastic pays $1.16 per pound. I had 7 pounds, so 7 times 116 comes $8.12. So you add that up, and it comes $18.48.
That's not so bad.
That's not bad at all. It's great. And you meet nice people, you know. Sometimes people give you things for free, give you recyclables for free. They see you, you know, working hard, trying to make a living, a legal living, you know, without stealing, without, you know, asking from anything. So, you know, every little bit helps.
Gary's feeling more optimistic about the future these days. He's hoping to get his own place and is looking to get out of the recycling business. He's now planning to become a gardener. In other words, he'll make things grow. And the cycle of life continues. And that'll do it for us. Lizzie's taking some time off. I'll be back again next week as we embrace springtime and explore new beginnings, mostly of the economic variety. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Jenny Ament and Eliza Mills, with help this week from Tobin Lowe and Aparna Alluri. Dan Samatovich is our senior producer. Daniel Ramirez is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. And as always, make sure to check with your financial advisor before making any investment decisions. I'm David Lazarus of the LA Times. Till next time, I'll see you in the business section. This is APM.